Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Presidents Trump and Putin head into their first face-to-face meeting. The fight over whether New Hampshire will supply voter information to the Trump administration's Election Integrity Commission will head to court. The price tag on damage from last weekend's storms continue to climb, but the weather has been good for New Hampshire's berries and those who eat them. A bumper crop of news this week on the Roundup. I am Josh Rogers, joined by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Casey McDermott from right here at NHPR. So it is Trump and Putin at the G20, and it is Kirk v. Gardner on the docket for Tuesday morning at Hillsborough County Courthouse. Singular personalities, one and all. I can't say I'm surprised the fight over the voter information is ending up in court. There, the issue will be over whether handing over voter information sought by President Trump's Election Integrity Commission comports with New Hampshire law. Casey, you've spent a lot of time on this issue this week and before. What's being sought, and what does the Secretary of State say he'll provide, and what does our law say can be provided?
So the letter that was sent out to states, about a week ago today, asked them to provide any number of pieces of information, but stipulated that the states were only being asked to provide that information if publicly available under the laws of their state. And that's a phrase that I've seen left out of a lot of coverage on this. So there's a lot of numbers being thrown around that, you know, 40 states are not complying fully or things like that. But in reality, a lot of those states that are being cited as those who are in non-compliance are actually just only providing what is, quote unquote, publicly available.
I mean, by last count, there were like 10 states that were maybe saying essentially hell no.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. So that's all to say that in New Hampshire, Secretary of State Bill Gardner has said that the state would turn over what can be accessed as part of the public voter checklists. So that would be name, mailing address, domicile address, party affiliation, and voting history back several cycles. So, you know, what party primary you voted in, things like that, not who you actually voted for. That obviously remains confidential. But people are unhappy with that for a number of reasons, one of which is that New Hampshire law says that only certain entities have the ability to get copies of the statewide voter checklist that Gardner says that he's going to provide to this commission. And they say the commission doesn't qualify under state statute. That's kind of the baseline argument that we're seeing in this lawsuit that was just filed.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Neil Kirk, he's the plaintiff in this lawsuit, along with State Senator Betty Lasky and the ACLU, but Neil Kirk's the lead plaintiff.
It's not a question of trying to hide something. It's a question of trying to make sure that information collected by the state of New Hampshire for one purpose is only used for that purpose and only within the state of New Hampshire, unless there are exceptions. I've worked with Secretary of State Gardner for years to make sure that these voter checklists were used only for that purpose and were not sent to provide a federal database.
All right, that's Neil Kirk, Republican lawmaker from Ware, staunch privacy advocate. Those who know him and his track record can't be too surprised by his stance. But, you know, in New Hampshire, this fight has been waged mostly along party lines, hasn't it, Dean?
That's right. And there are two issues here that I think we're talking about in parallel, and sometimes they cross. The first is the legal issue of what information is public and what do state regulations say specifically about how that information can be provided to not only political committees and campaigns and other organizations, but just in general. And so that's the first issue. And as we've been discussing already, the lawsuit really deals with whether or not the Secretary of State has the ability to just provide the data, the publicly available data on, you know, over 900,000 voters to the commission, just as kind of a big file. And the commission, the letter that Casey referenced, says that that data will be made, will be publicly available. So that raises an additional issue of privacy down the road. So that's the first issue, is the what data and how can it be provided. The second political issue revolves around this idea, and Secretary of State Gardner has mentioned this, that he's concerned about a lack of confidence, voter confidence in our electoral system. And, you know, the issue with this particular commission is I don't have a sense, given how partisan and volatile the issue is around electoral politics right now, I don't have a sense that it's necessarily going to go a long way towards assuaging any lack of voter confidence. And just to go back a little bit, because I think this has gotten lost, President Trump formed this commission by an executive order. His argument was that if you take out all the people who voted illegally in the 2016 election, he actually would have won the popular vote. Clearly, the fact that Clinton got 3 million more votes than him got under his skin. And his argument was very specific, and I think this has gotten lost. His argument was that 3 million people who were in the country illegally, so undocumented workers, not simply that 3 million people voted illegally, maybe they voted in two states or some other sort of, you know, getting on a bus and going to a different state. Trump's argument was that there were 3 million people who were in the country illegally and managed to vote. And this is part of an argument I've heard in conservative talk radio for many years, that Democrats, President Obama, are intentionally lax on immigration because it allows lots of undocumented workers in. They then get on federal services and state services. They then become kind of a built-in Democratic majority. Argument's been around for years. So this argument that Trump initially made about the 3 million voters is part of that argument about people being here illegally and being part of a Democratic majority. This is not simply about, it's kind of morphed into this argument about, well, people are registered in two states, which is not a crime unless you vote. So in any event, I think we've sort of lost sight of the initial argument. And you know, so this is not simply an issue of Trump trying to re-engineer or reverse engineer support for his claim. There's also another issue, certainly among Democrats, that this could, given Kris Kobach and his history, the Kansas Secretary of State, who's the vice chair who sent this letter out, given his own history in the courts, that this is kind of the beginning of a move towards voter suppression. So you know, whichever side of the argument you're on, this study, this commission, is going to be so polarizing that I don't see how Secretary of State Gardner's hope that this is going to somehow increase voter confidence is ever going to play out. I just think he's being a little naive there.
Trent?
I've seen the voter file. I think a lot of people don't realize that state law actually says specifically that a terminal needs to be available at the Secretary of State's office. It's actually at an annex off of Fruit Street in Concord. And it says that this terminal needs to be available for members of the public who want to go look at this voter registration file. And I was doing some reporting on a story. We were trying to confirm that some people who said they were, I think, registered Republicans were in fact registered Republicans. And so I was able to go in there. And I was able to look up their names, look up their addresses, and I could see not only how they were registered, but what this – we were looking at some presidential primary elections. You could see which ballot they
right.
picked. So as you know, in New Hampshire, you can be undeclared. You can – on election day, you can pick a Democratic or Republican ballot, and then you can become undeclared again. If you go to the Secretary of State's office, anyone listening right now can go to this office off of Fruit Street and can go look up their neighbors and their friends and, you know, that cousin you're always wondering who did they vote for. You can not you can't see who they actually voted for, but you can see how they're registered and what primary ballot they pulled. So there's actually a lot of information that's
well, you
available.
You can see it though, but you can't.
The issue I think is the
right.
copying of
right.
it.
So
and I would there's actually
how it's
a
provided.
Yeah,
and
there's a good article in the Monitor today that actually a reporter did what you just described, Trent, and went to the archives and actually tried to just see, you know, everyone is saying this is quote unquote publicly available, but there is a clear distinction in what you're able to actually you know, you can't take notes, you can't make copies of it, you can't take pictures of it. And that's the difference that people are trying to draw here with the distinction between what the commission is asking for in terms of an actual record of that versus what you can actually just sit down and
look at. And the argument is Secretary of State Gardner providing the entire voter file to this commission would be kind of extra legal outside of what the regulations say he can do.
Why don't we take a listen to what Governor Sununu said? He's saying he's deferring decision-making on this to Secretary of State Gardner and that the request from the commission went to the Secretary of State's office. But this is what he told a bunch of reporters, including me, earlier this week.
The Democrat Party not only has accesses, but uses it. The political candidates that are complaining about this use that very same information. I mean, I want to know why you guys aren't going and asking them. It seems very hypocritical to me that they would complain when they are using the information for their own personal purposes, and the federal government is simply asking for access to a system that they built.
Okay. A lot going on in that comment. Some, you know, the partisan politics you'd expect, but some details. I mean, Casey, when he's talking about candidates using that information, he's talking about the provision in state law that allows candidates, political committees to buy the voter checklist.
Right. So it is worth noting that about a decade ago, the New Hampshire Democratic Party went to court to fight for its ability to sell voter checklists, and which it now, you know, makes significant amount of money off of doing. But they're not the only ones who do buy voter checklists under state law. I did some reporting on this earlier this week and had done it previously while I was still at the Monitor on the people who are buying New Hampshire's voter data. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, if you talk to people, including Representative Kirk or, you know, Secretary Gardner or other people, I've asked them about this provision that allows political parties or political committees in the state to buy voter data. But the state, frankly, is pretty loose in how it defines political committees, and there doesn't appear to be a lot of, you know, checks on who counts as that. So, for example, the largest purchaser of voter data in the last decade is an out-of-state DC-based data firm that bills itself as a data hub. That provides information to campaigns and causes across the country. Similarly, more than half of all of the checklist sales since 2008 have been to these political committees. Many of them only have, you know, very thin ties to the state in the form of someone who they've just gotten to put their name on a political committee registration form. So, you know, while the law says that only political committees can use this and it can't be used for commercial purposes, I think there are questions to be raised around whether or not that's actually being followed, you know, as strictly as
that would
suggest.
Well, how do we know that the information, once it's out there and shared among candidates, political committees, how some of this doesn't sluice into the commercial realm? I mean, I guess it would be dependent on a prosecutor to figure that out.
It does. Yeah. And it's legal. You can buy, state law allows you to buy the voter registration list directly from the cities and towns. And these organizations do that. And here's what they do. I went to a two-day conference where they explain this. So what they do is they take your voter, your name, your domicile, the party that you what ballot you pulled, and then they add other stuff on top of it. So the parties can figure out, have you signed up with an email address? Okay, now that gets added to your file. Do you have a frequent shopper card where you scan to get a discount? Can they now tell that you're buying diapers? Can they tell that you are – do you have a frequent flyer mile? Can they tell that you're traveling a lot? And what they're able to do is compile sometimes hundreds of data points about you, where you live, what other people in your neighborhood are doing, how much money your neighborhood or even your block, you know, on average, how much money families on your block make. And what they're able to do is they say to a pretty high degree figure out how you're going to vote. And so what they say is if you have – purchased. Let's say you are, if you voted Democrat for the last four different election cycles and you make a certain amount of money and you live in this kind of neighborhood, they have a pretty good sense that you're going to vote for a Democrat. And so they're not going to spend money on trying to convince you to vote for the Democrat. Same for the Republican Party. And so what these companies try to do is take all these different data points, all these different marketing things that you sign up for, you don't really understand what the privacy issues are involved with them. You know, you sign that privacy statement, but you don't really know what it says. And so they take that voter file, they take all these different marketing points, and they put it all together in one file. People pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for this kind of information.
I think, though, and again, this gets back to the actual statute. The statute specifically bars people from using the information collected from the voter file for commercial purposes. And it actually defines commercial purposes as knowingly using, selling, giving, or receiving the checklist information for the purpose of selling or offering for sale any property or service unrelated to an election or political campaign. So I think that's where we run into.
Well, to anyone's knowledge, has there ever been a prosecution?
Not to my knowledge.
But here's the thing. Yeah. Here's the argument. And this is, you have to remember the lawsuit from 10 years ago is, yes, if you take this list, if you're a party and you take the list and sell it, yes, that is against the law, but they're not doing that. What they're doing is they're taking the list, they're adding value to it with email addresses, other kinds of touch points that they have about you, and then they're selling that. They're not selling the list. They're selling
an enhanced list
that they've produced, and that's what that lawsuit was about.
Okay, why don't we take a listen to what Bill Gardner said about why he feels it's important to get this information out there.
If we don't provide this, those people who believe that there is a lot of voter fraud are just going to be emboldened by that, because they're just going to say, what did they have to hide? What's the problem? This is just public information. This is public information that has been public in this state since the 1800s.
All right. That was Secretary of State Gardner earlier this week. He was talking to several reporters. I was one of them. He repeatedly used the word emboldened during the 15 or so minutes we talked to him. And when I asked him to clarify, he said essentially emboldened to further cast doubt on our elections. You know, there's a broad interpretation of that. You know, a more narrow one might be the New Hampshire primary. And I guess I'll put this to you, Trent. I mean, is there any reason to believe Bill Gardner fears noncompliance with the commission is going to put the primary at risk, particularly on the GOP side?
I think Bill Gardner is deeply upset about people who think that there are issues with our elections. I think that here's a person who has spent his entire life, his entire career, trying to make sure that we have fair elections in New Hampshire, and people are challenging his life's work, essentially. So I don't know what this means in the bigger scheme of the primary, but I think that when you hear Bill Gardner talk, I mean, even in that soundbite, this is deeply personal for him.
This gets back to my earlier comment about the political implications of this commission. If Secretary of State Gardner's desire is to strengthen voter confidence in the electoral system, you know, this is a very problematic way of doing it. The kind of, you know, what are they trying to hide argument is already taking place now. And, you know, a significant portion of the electorate believes that the people who are driving this commission, the executive order under which it was established, are suspect and are designed to ultimately move towards greater voter suppression. And, you know, I would ask this, if let's just say in a perfect world, this commission finds that our voter our electoral system is good and there's no voter fraud, et cetera, is President Trump going to accept that he really did lose by 3 million votes? I think that's not likely. We'll start to see tweets about the loser commission and the fake news undercutting the commission and the lack of data being provided by the states. This whole thing just seems like a real sort of problematic way to try to deal with the concerns that Secretary of State Gardner has. We can see it already, and they haven't even gotten started yet.
I would say that I think part of the reason why this is so problematic, and this gets at what you were talking about, Dean, you know, Secretary of State Gardner has told other reporters that he is trying to go into this with an open mind. He doesn't want to cast any preconceived notions despite all of the kind of polarization around this. But it is worth noting that the vice chairman of the commission, Chris Kobach, was among those, in addition to the president of the United States, who cast doubt specifically on the legitimacy of the votes in New Hampshire last election. After the president raised questions about buses of voters, people pouring into New Hampshire, Chris Kobach was someone who went on to news networks and defended that claim. So I think that's part of the reason that is leading people to be skeptical of the commission's motives in light of the secretary's involvement
on
it.
And I respect Secretary of State Gardner's desire to have a system which we're all confident in. This is not happening in a vacuum. And I think he's sort of turning a blind eye to the political context in which it's happening. And I just think this whole thing is just going to be incredibly problematic going forward.
Well, we'll see what happens. The hearing is going to be Tuesday in Hillsborough County Superior Court. The Secretary of State had said he planned to share the information at the end of the week pending input from the Attorney General's office. But Tuesday will be the next big development in this. Stick around, more after the break.
The creative process isn't always easy, but getting distracted can be.
It feels like you're writing, but it's the equivalent of empty calories.
If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day, it's not on Twitter. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, your source for the productive habits we can all benefit from, along with the guilty pleasures we can all relate to. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook or Twitter. Joined this morning by Casey McDermott from right here at NHPR, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. I want to turn to the court battle. We're waiting, the hearing at least, on Tuesday on the voter information to a ruling out this week from the state Supreme Court, one relevant to New Hampshire's efforts initiated in 2015 by former Attorney General Joe Foster to go after drug companies the state believes may have improperly marketed opioid painkillers. This ruling was seen as a win for the state. What was in that, Casey?
So basically, this goes back to just a little bit of background. About 2 years ago now, then Attorney General Joe Foster subpoenaed about 5 drug companies seeking records about their marketing practices and basically their role in propagating the state's opioid epidemic. This has now grown. It's kind of a multi-state effort against a number of companies. But one of the issues was that the companies, as is spelled out in court documents at least, initially agreed to comply with the request for those records, but then backtracked and in turn tried to prevent the state from being able to use outside law firms to help them in this lawsuit. So basically the main issue at question here was whether or not
that was permissible.
So while the ruling itself that was issued last week did not necessarily, to my understanding, change, say, yes, this is allowed, no, this is not allowed, it basically said that the pharmaceutical companies didn't have standing to challenge that, and they sent it back down to the lower court for reconsideration.
And, you look at the 5 companies that are involved in this, activists, Endo, Janssen, Purdue, and Teva, they could be on the hook for, obviously millions of dollars. As Casey mentioned, these cases are pending, involving different players in many states. I know they're going on in Oklahoma, Mississippi, Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, Tennessee, New York, some municipalities in California. You look at the understandable given the amount of money, you look at the briefs on this, and the local legal firepower is kind of interesting. You've got several top prosecutors. You've got a former U.S. attorney in David Vicinanzo. You have former Attorney General Mike Delaney. You've got other top prosecutors at the Attorney General's office now in private practice involved in the case. Before he became Attorney General, Gordon McDonald was one of the lawyers representing Purdue. He's now recused. This is something with big implications, and seems like some people believe this could be, akin to what happened with tobacco companies, Trent.
What's interesting about this is, and I think you bring up the point, which is that there is a lot of money at stakes here, both for the pharmaceutical companies and for the state. If the state were to win a judgment against some of these pharmaceutical companies for illegally marketing in New Hampshire, the state could potentially see a lot of money. You may remember that ExxonMobil just had to pay the state, I think it was like $300 million. That's a pretty good chunk of change for the New Hampshire state budget. And so what has been interesting for me as this case has evolved is to see how the Attorney General's office, which is funded by the legislature but doesn't have all the resources, all the money they need to really prosecute these massive multi-billion dollar companies, they have brought in outside counsel. And part of this Supreme Court issue has been whether the Attorney General's office has the authority to say to another law firm, hey, help us with this case, and whatever we win, you'll get a cut of. And so people have the pharmaceutical companies have argued that they're kind of just kind of raking them over for money. But the AG's office, their argument is we don't have the resources to compete against all the legal firepower that you're bringing against us. And we're just – I mean, at this point, the AG's office is not looking for a ton of information. They haven't really even filed like a legal claim. They're just looking for some information from
the after this ruling, Purdue issued a statement saying, quote, privatizing law enforcement presents serious public policy concerns, and that's, you know, one of the arguments.
Yeah, you know, the whole opioid crisis, and this case touches on it a little bit as well, has kind of turned a spotlight on the relationship between these pharma companies, doctors, and the whole issue of, you know, how are doctors incentivized to prescribe certain volume or certain types of drugs. And a couple close friends of mine who are doctors, and they often talk about kind of the pressure sales they get from the different pharma reps to use a particular type of drug or to make it more readily available, et cetera. So I think, you know, part of dealing with the opioid crisis is not only providing resources for people who are hit by it in terms of addiction, but also looking at the relationships between business, the medical community, and prescribing as well. And this sort of, in a way, these pharma companies and their advertising sort of touches on that as well.
Give us a call. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org and at @NHPRExchange. On Facebook and Twitter. Again, the phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You know, Dean, you mentioned prescribing habits. There's a report out this week from the CDC on opioid prescribing from 2010 to 2015 that found overall prescribing nationwide down 18% from its peak in 2010, but still very high prescribing rates in parts of the country and in New Hampshire, particularly according to this report along the eastern border, where enough pills were prescribed to keep every person medicated around the clock for, you know, at a minimum a month. The CDC found in particular problems in what it referred to as, quote, micropolitan areas. That's areas where cities and towns of populations between 10 and 50,000 people anchor more rural areas. You know, sounds a lot like New Hampshire.
Another interesting factoid from the CDC was they said that there was enough there was enough opioids prescribed, I think, to make sure that every single American could have whatever, you know, they needed for 3 weeks. Every single American for 3 weeks. So it is a shocking amount of opioids that are being prescribed. There was another fact where I think there was like one pill for every person in the state of New Hampshire. So, you know, they said this data only looked at 2012 through 2015. And in 2015, I think, is when we really started to see a lot of the awareness among prescribers and doctors. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what happens after 2015. They said that this was kind of I think the term they used was glimmer of hope. But I think we'll have to see what happened after 2015.
I mean, we do now have you know, prescription drug monitoring program, which we were the second to last state to adopt. We have prescribing guidelines. But one thing that, you know, experts will say is that volume prescribing can be driven by a small number of prescribers. And, you know, there are other factors that that this report found to be coincident with particularly high prescribing rates, including high rates of arthritis, diabetes, where the population is largely white and old. You know, and Medicaid enrollment is high. You know, New Hampshire ticks some of those boxes. You know, unemployment is also a big factor. We obviously are low there. But do tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Why don't we go to the phones? Mike is on the line from Concord. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Josh. It's Mike Lewis.
How are you? Go right ahead.
Good. I wanted to just respond to some very astute observations that both you and Trent were making about under-resourcing in the area of public lawyering, because it connects, I think, to not just the stories around activists, but also other stories that the union leader in particular has reported on in the last couple weeks involving some very serious issues in Hillsborough County and in the Manchester City Solicitor's Office. What Trent observed is a concern that about the Attorney General's office and their capacity to handle a series of different cases, their desire to go outside of the state to seek assistance. This is just one of a series of different concerns we're facing generally in the area of public lawyering, where in New Hampshire right now we have no U.S. attorney, so there's no top political appointment to the U.S. Attorney's office. We have county attorneys of disparate capacities, whether it's Tom Dewhurst in Carroll County, who had to have a requisition of assistant attorney generals go up to cover major issues going on there, whether you had the Reams slash Conway issues in Rockingham County, and now you have reports, you know, regarding County Attorney Hogan and the city solicitor's office and their capacities to handle domestic violence issues. All of the constellation of these problems should raise red flags for all of us regarding, you know,
how to solve them. How to solve them? Simple resources. Well, I mean, obviously, county attorneys are elected.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some very serious questions that we need to ask about the continued fragmentation of public lawyering in the state. Whether it makes sense to continue the ancient tradition of county-by-county prosecutions, given how connected the legal mental health and drug issues are across county lines in a small state like our own.
All right, Mike, thank you. Lots to think about there. But, I mean, certainly, you know, it is, you know, the issues he cites, and we're going to get to some of the stuff going on in Manchester a bit later in the show, do raise questions about, you know, how well the public is sometimes served by its public servants.
I first met Mike Lewis, the caller. He was an assistant attorney general prosecuting a capital murder trial in Rockingham County. And Mike and that whole trial team must have worked 18 hours a day. It was incredible to watch. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever looked at state salaries, but they're not quite what you make in the private sector. And so, yeah, I think Mike brings up a great point that the AG's office has a lot on their plate every single day.
All right. Why don't we go back to the phones? Carl is on the line from Wyndham. Good morning, Carl. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. So the point I want to make is, you know, it's important to keep track of all these opioid problems. But one thing that's really hurt is legitimate users. You know, I have to drive to my doctor's office every month to get a prescription, to take it to the pharmacy. Can't do it mail order. You just, you know, it's really burdensome for legitimate users.
So do you suffer from chronic pain of some sort?
I do. I have spinal stenosis, so I have back pain. It really bothers me. And, you know, I only take one of these pills a day, and some days I try not to take it. But, you know, clearly it's really a pain to me to have to drive to my doctor, take that paper to the pharmacy, and do that.
I mean, do you think the pendulum has swung too far in trying to rein in prescribing due to problems that it's, you know, adversely affecting people who have legitimate issues and aren't abusing the drugs?
I absolutely do. I mean, and, you know, it's pretty easy to tell if someone's getting a ton of these prescribed to them versus, you know, I get 30 a month, you know, one a day. And some months I don't even get my prescription, or I push it out a week or two just because I don't need that many.
All right, Carl, thanks for the input. You know, that was one interesting thing in the CDC report that was how to read this report. In a way, the reining in of some prescribing, you know, leaves people who have real chronic pain and use a lot of opioids. It doesn't sound like Carl necessarily fits into this category. So essentially you have, you know, people in chronic pain who, for lack of a better term, are kind of like, you know, prolific, in need of prolific amounts of medication, potentially skewing the numbers and concealing a decline was one kind of caveat that came with that CDC
report. I think some of the media coverage has also caused concern among patients, and I've heard this from doctors and nurses, and actually some people who I had one friend who she had back surgery, which is painful, and they gave her like a week of opioids to just kind of help her with the pain, and she didn't want to take it because she was too concerned about getting hooked and then having to find heroin on the street. And you know, you talk to doctors and nurses who say that is not what's going to happen. I mean, just taking the right prescription and being monitored by a doctor, you aren't going to all of a sudden be hooked and be looking for heroin.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I think that's true. My own anecdotal experience from talking to people who have had injuries or broken bones or what have you, there is a concern now that you're going to become addicted from taking these for a few weeks to deal with an injury. You know, I'm to Carl's point, it's just sort of the reality of whenever you're dealing with an abuse situation like this with medications or drugs, it's just kind of natural for regulations to look at limiting or more strictly controlling kind of what's out there in the public. And in his case, unfortunately, it's made his life a bit more complicated.
I mean, just not, you don't necessarily have to end up, you know, kind of telling people to chew on a piece of leather or something. But I will say anecdotally, having had medical procedures where they're like, oh, here's a big jar of pills that, you know, I don't necessarily need, that often comes with the territory. And that's something that some of the prescribing guidelines, including those that might make somebody like Carl have to drive to pick up prescription, are hoping to avert.
I will say that in addition to more emphasis on this on the prescribing side, there are a number of medical institutions in New Hampshire that are trying to do more education on the patient side as well. So if, for example, you know, I go and have a medical procedure done, as you said, Josh, and I'm given all of these drugs that I don't end up using, they're trying to create more ways for people to bring those back safely, teach them how to dispose those drugs, because a lot of the drugs, you know, as I think we alluded to before, that are, you know, leading to people developing addictions, are left over from procedures.
And, you know,
procedures.
There's also the issue of reimbursability of non-opioid treatments. I mean, obviously drugs, a lot of them are reimbursable by insurers. Other potential treatments, aren't always are. So that's certainly another thing people are looking at. But, you know, why don't we move on to another ongoing and sometimes related issue to the opioid crisis, and that's the state's mental health crisis. It was a big focus for policymakers during the budget, was on boosting mental health treatment. You know, the state's now accepting applications for providers of some of those services being contemplated. I know you wrote something about this, Casey, this week. So what contracts are out there, and what's the timeline on this anticipated boost in services?
Yeah. So just by way of a little bit of context, obviously the legislative session just wrapped up within the last month or so. There was a lot of emphasis there on a number of kind of mental health reform bills. There was a big package that kind of provided for additional beds, additional other services, but then a lot of the money that was actually going to make that happen was coming through the state budget. So now that both of those things have been signed, that has allowed the state's Department of Health and Human Services to basically open up a call for contracts for providers to actually, you know, put in place more treatment beds, things like that. So there are about, I think, four different contracts that were opened up last week, one of which is for a provider, either a hospital or non-hospital facility, to act as a designated receiving facility. So this would basically be a place where people who are experiencing a mental health crisis and awaiting admission in, you know, the state hospital or some other institution. Right now, those people are being boarded in emergency rooms in high numbers. We know that's been a problem for a while. So what the state is looking for is more places for people to go to, you know, while they're waiting for treatment to open up. That's one of the key components here. I believe the timeline for that is around October, ideally, of later this year. But that, again, will be contingent upon, you know, what kind of contracts they get in terms of people being able to provide that. Other things that the state is looking to get up and running is a new mobile crisis team, which would be, again, this emphasis on providing more supports in the community to avoid, you know, unnecessary institutionalization, or also just kind of alleviate the strain that exists right now on the state hospital, things like that. That team is asked to be ready to launch by January of next year. So that's all to say that, you know, there was a lot of fanfare around these reforms being passed, but it's still going to take some time before they're actually up and running.
And there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on
exactly
how well they
yeah
get up and running. And this is, you know, with the backdrop of mental health settlement, and certainly Governor Sununu talked about trying to create a system where, in his kind of engineering speak, the proper throughput would allow people in need of service to get the service without overbuilding. So that's going to be something to watch. Do stick around, more after the break on the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Casey McDermott, NHPR, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. You know, if the mental health enhancements that the state is planning get set up, you know, the state's also dismantling and recasting another bit of government, and I guess by that I mean the Department of Resources and Economic Development. That went by the wayside this week, and with it, the acronym DREAD. The department is being split in two. We'll have the Department of Business and Economic Affairs and the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. Is this sort of a bureaucratic reorganization significant, Dean?
I think that the thinking behind it is that it will be more efficient, that it'll allow for, you know, better targeting of economic opportunities on the one hand and kind of natural cultural resources on the other. I'm going to miss DREAD. Has always been one of my favorite bureaucratic acronyms. We'll see. You know, it's not unusual for chief executives or executive branches to want to do a little bit of reorganization at times. And the thinking is that this is going to make it more efficient and effective. We'll see.
You know, Taylor Caswell, Governor Sununu's pick to oversee economic development and travel and tourism, should he be confirmed, will be one commissioner. Jeff Rose, the DREAD commissioner, would oversee forest, lands, state parks, cultural resources. The governor says the reorganization assignment shouldn't be seen as a judgment on how Jeff Rose acquitted himself as DREAD commissioner, but simply of a piece to show New Hampshire is open for business. There have been some cost questions raised about whether this reorganization will cost the state money. The governor's office says no. At least one Democratic state senator says yes, Trent.
I think it's going to cost money. I mean, the commissioner, that's a six-figure job. They're hiring additional staff for the new. This is going to cost money. The question is how much. The legislature heard some testimony that would be about $2 million a year. I'm not sure it's going to be that much. But they are – I mean, they're hiring a new commissioner. They're hiring – additional staff, so that'll cost some money. I thought the governor's quote from the ceremony announcing all of this, or his quote was, "Dread is dead." His focus, and both during the campaign and his first 100 days, was he said that he was going to get rid of dread, that it was difficult to go outside of the state and say, "Oh, why don't you come to New Hampshire, meet my dread commissioner, and we can talk about how to get you here." So I think the question is going to be, how much money is this going to cost? Will there be a return on investment for the taxpayer?
That's the question.
Right.
Well, you know, as that reorganization is underway, another one is underway in Manchester, where Mayor Ted Gatsis is now overseeing the city prosecutor's office after the resignation of longtime city solicitor Tom Clark over his office's handling of domestic violence cases. Tom Clark, according to the reporting in your paper, Trent, was getting paid $161,000 a year, was seemingly asleep at the switch in his office, particularly over prosecutor Andrea Mueller failing to do real basic things in handling domestic violence cases.
The attorney general's office went into the Manchester prosecutor's office, and they basically went through – they spent dozens of hours going through cases. And what was happening was and there's some legalese here, but essentially what was happening was police were arresting people. And these people who are charged with domestic violence crimes are not going all the way up to Superior Court. They're just being handled in district court. And so the county attorney and the full-time county attorney's office, they weren't handling these cases. They weren't being indicted, and they were being handled in district court. And the prosecutor who handled those cases was basically saying, look, we'll drop these charges if you meet certain conditions. And then they would keep track of the conditions but would never go back and enforce the conditions. So in several cases, the attorney general's office found that these conditions, in fact, were not met and that charges should have been brought back because the conditions were not met, and they just never were. And there was a lot of finger pointing that happened here. the Manchester City Solicitor is responsible for that office. But ultimately, the Attorney General's office said that the county attorney, Dennis Hogan, should be the first.
Well, and he said he didn't know about any of this.
And he said he didn't know about any of this. He was sent letters by the Attorney General's office saying that you are in charge of this office, ultimately, that the Attorney General's office, we're in charge of all law enforcement in the state, but you are the first line here. You are the first line supervisor. So you're supposed to be in charge of the city solicitor. You're supposed to be in charge of this prosecutor who is handling domestic violence cases. So, I think, that's an elected position, the county attorney. So it'll be interesting to see whether there's any political fallout for Dennis Hogan.
And this whole thing was set in motion, correct, by Manchester Police Chief Nick Willard notifying the Attorney General of his concerns.
Right, who could have gone to Dennis Hogan and said, hey, I have concerns about this office. But according to some of the reporting, didn't have faith in that office, and so went right to the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General's office, as the ultimate law enforcement group in the state, they were able to come in and take a look at all these cases. But yeah, I mean, he essentially went over the county attorney's head.
And so some of the cases in question, at least those where the statute of limitations has not run, those are going to be reevaluated.
Those are going to be reevaluated. And the Attorney General's office said they went through a list of these cases and they said, they specifically named the cases and said you should bring charges by this date on this case, and the Manchester City Solicitor's Office didn't do it, and that's when they really went public with these concerns.
And so you mentioned the political implications potentially for County Attorney Hogan. Mayor Gatsas has got an election coming up sooner than he does. It's unclear to me exactly what his role is in overseeing Mayor Gatsas isn't a lawyer. He's sort of riding herd on the office until when or what? Until a new solicitor is in there? Is that clear at this point?
Yes, he is. I mean, Mayor Ted Gatsas is now handling the day-to-day operation of the Manchester City Solicitor's Office, which is interesting. We've worked with the city solicitor's office on all kinds of other things. I mean, set aside the domestic violence stuff for a minute. Try getting the public information about people who work for the city of Manchester and what their salaries are. I mean, every single year we ask for the city salaries, right? And we run in the paper. That's what we do. We've been doing it forever. Try to get that kind of information. I mean, the city solicitor's office has this policy where even if they send you an email, I mean, they had a spreadsheet of all the city salaries. And they charged us $13 to literally click attach on an email and send it to us. So there are a lot of I think there were a lot of other issues with the city solicitor's office. And there was some friction between the mayor's office and the city solicitor's office, between the city solicitor's office and people who do business with the city, including the press, the right to know law, all kinds of other issues. So we had never heard that there was an issue with the domestic violence portion of what they do, but we had heard that there were issues with the office.
Well, and it sounds like the mayor wants to at least get an interim official in there who can then do a comprehensive review of the whole office.
All right. So, certainly lots more to watch that. The political implications there remain to be seen, as do another the developments around the rape at West High School. The victim there has David Gottesman, a former state senator, her lawyer, someone who's quite experienced as a trial lawyer. David Gottesman was fairly terse when he talked to your paper, Trent, but do you have a sense that a suit is pretty likely?
Yes. And just to recap what happened here, almost 2 years ago, a young woman was raped in a hallway at West High School. Officials at West High School knew that this hallway was a concern. There was a school resource officer who was actually in the vicinity at the time of the rape, looked down the hallway, and because of the way it was arranged, saw a locked door and basically said, oh, nothing to see here, and moved on. And so I think even if you talk to people who work for the city, they will say that the city failed this person, that they failed this victim. No one said anything. This girl was raped during school hours at West High School. No one said anything about this for 2 years, not the superintendent, police chief, county attorney, not the mayor. And you want to talk about finger pointing. There was a lot of that going on about whose job it was. Ted Gatsas called everybody in and said, OK, we're going to have a policy from now on. But were it not for Mark Hayward's story that we ran on the front page detailing asking all these people, hey, why didn't anybody say anything to the parents who send their kids to West High School every day? Nothing would have happened. Nothing would have happened.
And this, and just to be clear, this really only became publicly known due to the sentencing of the perpetrator and a release from the county attorney's office on that.
Correct. I mean, the guy was sentenced on a Tuesday, I want to say, and 2 days later they sent out a press release. And Mark Hayward, the reporter at the Union Leader, said, wait a second, somebody was raped at West High School. We're now hearing about 2 days after he was sentenced.
It's interesting, you know, anybody who's had kids who have gone through particularly junior high and high school, you often get these kinds of communications from the or email from the school, you know, kind of laying out a situation, but having for legal reasons to be kind of vague about, you know, who is involved and sort of the specific details for privacy issues. It sounds like they didn't even get to that level of informing parents with this particular case.
My understanding, I mean, based on the reporting that you've had in your paper, Trent, is that school board members were notified the day of the incident. So that's another
community to the parents.
Exactly. Right. And that I think is where a lot of people are, you know, as you said, are upset. I will say just I've done a little bit of reporting on this since and in talking to people just particularly about that notification component and the things that you need to balance there. I think that if you talk to anyone, this particular case is complicated in that it involves two people who are under the age of 18 at the time of the incident. That creates kind of additional considerations. In addition to the fact that, you know, if you talk to kind of, you know, people who are in the advocacy community for victims of sexual violence, they will say, as has been suggested, that, you know, you really have to be sensitive about that person's privacy. But at the same time, I think that, you know, the question is, how do you balance that with, as we've suggested, and as I think you see in a lot of kind of the conversation around this, you know, the need to let parents know whether or not their child is in a safe environment at school.
I've seen that balance firsthand. I've gotten emails from junior highs and high schools where you kind of know something happened, mm-hmm. but they can't really give you details. And so the parental mm-hmm. kind of information, informal networks kick into high gear usually to sort of learn a little bit more about what the situation is and what the potential risk is to your children.
And there are a number of competing kind of federal laws in particular in terms of, you know, student privacy that schools will often fall back on as excuses for not releasing any information. But in many cases that, you know, that doesn't necessarily preclude them from releasing any information.
Yeah, we saw some chatter on social media, including from advocates for victims, basically saying there should have been no press release about this. You know, I don't think there is a question of balance. I think that we talked to several lawyers who said that there would have been absolutely no federal, state, or local law that would have banned anyone from saying there was a sexual assault at high school. It involves two juveniles. We can't release details of their names, the crimes, anything like that. No one's asking for the details. Right. People are just the parents we talked to were just asking to know that a very serious felony was committed in the hallways of West High School, that somebody was arrested, and that police were investigating.
All right. Stay tuned to the fallout from that story. You know, I want to turn quickly to the weather. You know, there's flooding last week that did do real damage. The state says it tops FEMA thresholds for federal disaster relief. And, you know, some of this flash flooding happened pretty quickly and certainly came as an alarm to some people in the state doing some camping. Why don't we take a listen to what a camper in Campton told a reporter from NHPR.
My boyfriend woke up at 2 because he had to pee, and when we unzipped the tent, we were on like 4 or 5 feet of water floating. Holy Our God. Tent had actually lifted and moved about 25 feet from where we had fallen asleep, and we had been caught in the trees. They were holding us in place. And we had no idea. Even our dog was in the tent. We were all completely oblivious. Wow. Had no clue.
All right. At least the family was all together in the tent. They were camping next to the Pemigewasset River in Campton. You know, Governor Sununu toured the state by helicopter, requested in for a FEMA declaration. Obviously, those things are kind of pro forma after a weather event. It'll be interesting to see whether there's any change in how that's handled under Trump administration. You know, I do want to note before we close that the weather, and certainly not the torrential rain recently, but the weather has been very good for berries, the farmers of New Hampshire. And I can report anecdotally that the few berry bushes in my yard are looking good. And, you know, there are strawberries out there at present that are, you know, giant.
I'm a part-time blackberry farmer myself, and it looks like I'm going to have the biggest crop I've ever had in almost 10 years.
Okay, congratulations, Trent. You know, I've learned about your agricultural endeavors. I do want to, before we go, I do want to touch on quickly policy, your paper, The Union Leader, the demise of the online comment section, which, you know, can be a diverting thing for people who read a lot of news.
Yes, that's right. Unionleader.com no longer accepting comments anymore. Our new president, Brendan McQuaid, who took over in January this year, dug into some of our numbers and found that about 50 people were really the main comment, more than 90% of our commenters. And so on any given day, you'd have these 50 people contributing hundreds and hundreds of comments. And if anyone's ever read the comments, you could see that some of them could be
It
could get a little dark. I can tell you, as a news guy, as a reporter, as an editor, the comments would sometimes be helpful because you could see people would send links to, hey, you guys missed this, or do you remember this? And so that was helpful. And so we're still encouraging people to communicate with us by sending letters to the editor, by sharing stuff on social media. We are still looking for feedback about our work. We still want to hear from people. But we are just taking a pause on the comments, and we're going to see how that goes.
All right. Okay. We have to take a pause in a minute to quit the show. But before I go, I do want to ask, it is the time of the year when sometimes news is scarce. But what is on the horizon for all of us? What's on the horizon for you next week, Casey?
Well, it's certainly not scarce on the election law beat. I will be going to that hearing next week and also just continuing to follow the fallout from that, as well as I mentioned, going to be trying to look, you know, at some of the issues that we talked about, particularly around the notification component of that Manchester West story.
Trent, what's coming up in the Union Leader?
I definitely recommend picking up the New Hampshire Sunday News. Mark Hayward is going to be digging into a lot more of that, of some of those Manchester controversies, and he'll have some interesting reporting.
Dean?
Also going to be following the voter file hearing and see how that develops. I also want to draw attention to my latest Pints in Politics interview. I sat down yesterday with Senator Hassan, and we talked a lot about North Korea and the health care bill in the Senate. You can find a link to that interview at nhpoliticalcapital.com.
All right. Thanks for everyone. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend, all.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.